Okay, now when I leave, I'm just going to silently leave. Both of my computers will still be on, so it will look like I'm here, but it's for the recording and all of that.
Okay.
So.
Well, there's just a small group here. Well, hopefully more will join. I think this particular webinar series is in the greatest danger of being ended, because I, as you all can, I'm sure, understand, I need at least 10 people in order to continue with this series, because it takes so much work to put them together. But I love this series. I wish that it had caught on better, but maybe a few more will trail in. But if it stays at this rate, which means that there's really just six of you outside of myself and BL, we'll have to pull the plug on it. Be a shame, but that
Okay, if you pull the plug on it, will you
I won't do it today.
email? Oh, I was going to say, if you email me, then I can know that it was
No,
logged in from coming and turn it off and.
right. No, it's the preparation that, I don't want to do. This is prepared for already. So, I happy to give it. And we have a few more coming in.
Yeah, we do.
So that's good.
Yeah.
We're
And for Veronica has her hand up.
hovering on the brink, but we haven't fallen over yet. We now have nine with us. And
Speak
Veronica.
for yourself about not falling over yet.
Oh,
It
as
won't happen, Francis. Don't be quick to judge. They will come in.
yeah, okay. Well, I'm not going to judge on the initial group. I'm going to judge on the final group that shows up. So, and we're just one shy of the requirement. But as I said, this is already prepared, so I'm going to give this just to the nine of you, and who knows, maybe a few more will show up. BL is in post-surgery kind of survival mode, and so she will just stay with us as long as she feels like it. But I will be calling on you. So what I'm going to do is handle this just like one of my smaller webinar series where I'm looking at all of you. If you want to show your faces, if you want to start your videos, so.
Oh, I'll have to let him do that, Francis. I said I wouldn't allow them. Okay. They can now start their videos.
Yeah, why don't we do that? Why don't we? It doesn't work for over 20, but I think it works for a group this small. And this group now never gets over 20. So yeah, let them show their videos. And so just click on your video screen. You're not required to at all. Yeah, and Veronica says, hope you get well soon. BL, we all echo that sentiment for sure. Yeah, and it's something. I hope this new knee really does serve you well.
I hope so too. Sorry, guys, I'm a total wreck right now.
Yeah. Why don't you, well, just stay as long as you want.
See,
That's
I'm trying to show myself, but
you're showing.
I have to be smarter than the this is a poor little pitiful me.
Well, we care about you a lot, and we wish you big,
And
speedy recovery.
they say the first 90 days you're wondering why in the hell you did this, and the
Right.
next 90 days you're saying, this ain't so bad. And after that, you're saying, oh man, thank God I did this.
Yeah. Okay. Good to know. All right, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to this 69th webinar on the secret teachings of all ages by Manly P. Hall. Our group is shrinking. If it consistently falls under 10, which it is right now, I'll have to pull the plug on preparing for it because it takes about 30 hours to create a webinar. As much as I would hate for that to happen, so hopefully we can keep it at least in the minimum level. This webinar series is available on Mercara.us and is subheading More Federation Webinars, the webinar series in progress. Previous episodes of this, The Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you would like to view. I gave a 3-hour presentation on the meaning of the cross in the life of the disciple and the technique of fusion yesterday morning, my local time, evening in Europe. And that hopefully that recording will soon be available on Mercara.us if you're interested in that subject. Okay, we are currently in the chapter entitled The Bimbene Table of Isis, which is also known as the Mensa Isiaca after Isis. So we'll start by taking a quick review of the nomenclature of the table, since it's a bit complicated. And I'll be paraphrasing MPH's words. Quote, the table is divided into three equal compartments, the upper, the middle, and the low. Above are personified the 12 signs, and below are the corresponding four quarters of the horizon, while in the middle panel are 21 figures which correspond to the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. In the center of this center panel is a seated figure, which MPH calls the pantomorphic INX. This Isis-like figure is an emblem of universal being that corresponds to the Hebrew yod, the letter, according to some, from which all the other letters were formed. The INX is encircled by an ophite or serpent-like triad, answering to the three mother letters of the Hebrew alphabet. On the left are the ibomorphic Serapian triads, and Serapian triads. On the right are those of, excuse me, and on the right are those of Nephthys and Hecate, representing active and passive, fixed and volatile, fructifying fire and generating water. So that's MPH's description. Okay, so each pair of triads, okay, represent energetic opposite, with Thoth and the solar Serapis representing the active, fiery, volatile aspect, and Nephthys and Hecate representing the quote-unquote passive, fixed, water-generating aspect. These two triads are the positive and negative poles that are each philosophically completed by the central figure. Here's the central figure. So you see him here completed. In addition, each pair becomes a completed septenary through association with their source. So you have these two, the six of these two is completed through the seventh by association with the central. And the same thing with these two. The central figure is also septenary, as shown here. And that's our quick review. During our last session, we explored the diagram by Eliphas Levi, reproduced in the center of the first page of this chapter, which, when paired with explanations found in W. Wynne Westcott's The Ethiac tablet reveals much about this Bimbine table. It's really the best description available from the books I looked at. It's really the best description you can find, and it's incomplete compared to, you know, whatever discipline originated with the tablet. Those who used the tablet in the first place would have been much more versed, even than Westcott was able to discern. Okay, the diagram uses symbols. That's up these top triads to identify the gods portrayed. For example, in the upper register, we learn the identity of the gods and goddesses personifying each of the zodiacal signs, as well as specifics about the relationship within each of these triads, which is made up of a pater or father, a potentia, the active creative force of the triad, and mens, mind or divine intellect. And they're set apart in this way in Westcott's description by these letters. So we learn which is which. After exploring each triad in the upper register, we took a look at the lower register, which articulates the nature of the gods and goddesses of each directional quadrant. East, connected with new beginnings, enlightenment, and the rising sun, symbolizes birth, renewal, and the awakening of consciousness. South, linked with warmth, growth, and vitality, symbolizes the physical world and the energy of life. And west, associated with endings, transitions, and the setting sun, represents the passage into the afterlife and the mysteries of the unknown. We then explored just one of these directions more fully, the east, in depth. Westcott's descriptions are both rich and insightful. For example, quote, Horus is the sun, which confers heat and light to our earth and rises in the east. The network, talking about this on his body, points out that its origin and powers are hidden from our knowledge. We then took a look at the segment of Levi's chart that depicts the middle register, about which MPH states, the central region he ascribes to the solar powers and the planetary. In the middle, we see above the sun marked OPS, OPS, and below it is a Solomon seal above the cross, a double triangle or hexapla, one light and one dark triangle superimposed, the whole forming a sort of complex symbol of Venus. This is the symbolic representation of the IYNX, the central emanating source of the entire Mensa Ithiaca. We then learned that, quote, to the Ibimorphus, he gives the three dark planets, Venus, Mercury, and Mars, placed around a dark triangle erect, denoting fire. We here see that the three planetary symbols reveal the identity of these gods and goddesses, Venus, Hermanubis, and Mars. And finally, we took a look at the watery Nephthian triad, represented by a down-pointing triangle, who personifies the planet Saturn, the moon, and Jupiter, about which Westcott says, there is a necessary connection between water, female, power, passive principle, Bina, and Sephirotic mother and bride. After that, we explored the text beneath Levi's illustration, which interestingly doesn't really have much to do with this illustration. He gives us that description in the main text, but instead it relates the Mincha Isiaka via the ancient Egyptian book of Toth to the Tarot. But this attempt to link the book of Toth and the Tarot only originated as a result of an occult revival in the 19th and early 20th centuries, when scholars and mystics sought to connect the Tarot with ancient wisdom and esoteric knowledge. The first to do so was the French occultist Antoine Cour de Gobelin in the late 18th century. In his 1781 work, Le Monde Primitif, he puts forward the idea that the Tarot had ancient Egyptian origins and linked it to the Book of Toth. But he gave no evidence, no empirical evidence to support this link. In fact, there is no mention of the Tarot before 1440, when it was first introduced, not as a philosophical tool, but as a deck of playing cards. In fact, the later versions of the Tarot became increasingly esoteric with the Rider Waite, Crowley's deck, and my favorite being the Builders of the Aditum, or Bota, which have quite a lot of important symbolism in them. Next, MPH introduces the relation between the Hebrew alphabet and the major arcana of the Tarot. We ended our last session with an excerpt from Paul Foster Case's book, The Tarot, on how the Hebrew letter Aleph relates to the Fool Arcanum. And with this example, we get a real strong sense of the importance of these Hebrew letters in terms of deciphering the meaning of the tarot cards themselves. Okay, so we'll start today's session by reading this passage from page 58 of the folio edition. So could we get a reader, please? Oh, I bet BL has stepped out. So if you'd like to read or would volunteer to read, please just raise your hand. And Veronica, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Note the ancient signs, for the planets were all composed of a cross, solar disk, and a crescent. Venus in a cross below a sun disk, Mercury a disk with a crescent above and a cross below. Saturn is a cross whose lowest point touches the apex of the crescent. Jupiter is a crescent whose lowest point touches the left hand of a cross, and these are deep mysteries. Note that Levi in his original plate transposes Serapis and Ekate, but not the Apis Noir and the Apis Blanc, perhaps because of the head of Bes being associated by him with Ekate. Note that having referred the 12 simple letters to the lower, the seven double must correspond to the central region of the planets, and then the great triad AMS, the mother letters representing air, water, and fire, remain to be pictured around S, the central lynx or yod, by the Ophonian triad, the two separants, and the Leonian sphinx. Levi's words OPS in the center is the Latin ops terra, genius of the earth, and the Greek ops rea, or jubilee, Cybele, often drawn as a goddess seated in a chariot drawn by lions. She is crowned with turrets and holds a key. See the Isaac Tablet. The essay published in French by Alexandre Lenoir in 1809, while curious and original, contains little information of the tablet, which the author seeks to prove was an Egyptian calendar or an astrological chart. As both Montfaucon and Lenoir, did I say that?
Montfaucon.
I can't say that. And Lenoir, in fact, all writers on the subject since 1651 either have based their work upon that of Kitcher or have been influenced considerably by him. A careful translation has been made of the letter original article, 8 pages of 17th century Latin. The double page plate at the beginning of this chapter is a faithful reproduction made by Kircher from the engraving in the Museum of Hieroglyphs. The small letters and numbers used to designate the fingers were added by him to clarify his commentary and will be used for the same purpose in this work.
Thank you, Anne Veronica. Okay, first up. Note the ancient signs for the planets were all composed of a cross, solar disk, and crescent. Venus is a cross below, a sun disk. Mercury, a disk with a crescent above and cross below. Saturn is a cross whose lowest point touches the apex of the crescent. Jupiter is a crescent whose lowest point touches the left-hand end of a cross. All these are deep mysteries. So let's take a closer look at each of the elements that make up the symbols for Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn. The cross represents structure, matter, and the fixed organizing principle underlying the physical universe, including the four elements and the cardinal directions defining time and space. The circle or solar disk represents the spirit aspect, unity, the totality of existence, and the primordial source from which all things emerge. It can also represent the ring past not. The crescent represents receptivity, intuition, and the ever unfolding dynamic quality of the life aspect. So we might say that Mercury, comprising a disk with a crescent above and a cross below, symbolizes a state of consciousness that has transcended the lower quaternary and suggests, by means of the crescent, mediation between the spiritual and material worlds. The Venus symbol also symbolizes a state of consciousness that has transcended the lower quaternary. But here the circle has more specifically the quality of the soul, suggesting that it is the source of the cross that emanates from it, and that it continually nurtures that emanation until such time that it is drawn back up into the circle. The lowest point of the crescent linked to the cross of matter in the symbol of Jupiter, talking about right here, suggests a dynamic interplay between the expansive influence of spirit and the structured manifestation of the lower three worlds. Of note in this symbol is that the crescent is aligned with the vertical arm of the cross, and unlike with the Mercury symbol, is in direct contact with the cross. Hence it is its expansive influence on all manifestation. And when we extend the crescent to a circle, it suggests an alignment with and influence from, a higher cosmic source. In the symbol of Saturn, the cross placed above the crescent denotes the higher organizing principle. It embodies the structure, discipline, and the imposition of order upon the chaotic potential of the form world, and is thus linked to karmic law, time, and the necessary boundaries that shape and define manifested life. Of course, these are just some of the associations that can be made, but undoubtedly there are more esoteric meanings to these symbols, as MPH suggests with the phrase, all these are deep mysteries. Any thoughts or questions about these symbols or their meanings? Okay, even though it's just a handful of you, just remember dialogue is always more interesting than monologue. So raise your hand if you have any thoughts or questions at any point. Okay, next up. Note that Levi in his original plate transposed Serapis and Hecate, but not the Apis Noir and Apis Blanc, perhaps because of the head of Bes being associated by him with Hecate. Okay, so this is a minor point, but here's Levi's geometrical illustration below the central panel that it represents. MPH is simply pointing out that Levi has switched the positions of Serapis and who's here, and Hecate triads, that these are reversed. But not the positions of the Apis Noir and the Apis Blanc that stand above them. The Serapian triad, called in Levi's illustration Le Triple Serapis, is actually found in the lower right quadrant, of the central panel, and the triad of Hecate, which is illustrated here, is actually found in the lower left quadrant. Here's a close-up of the latter. But we're not going to read this now because it comes up later in the, we will read it later in the series. Next, note that having referred the 12 simple letters to the lower, the seven double must correspond to the central region of the planets. So here are the 12 simple letters in relation to the lower group, letters and these lower 12. And here are the seven double letters, each associated with one of the planets, which MPH says, quote, must correspond to the central region. So the key provided through Levi's illustration gives us the identity of these planets. And Westcott gives us a description. Quote, the seven doubles which correspond to the planets and the median part of the Isiac tablet, Beth, Luna, nature, of course the moon, Gimel, Mars, or force, Daleth, the sun, fertility, Kaf, Venus, generation, Pe, Mercury, wisdom, Resh, Saturn, peace, Dao, Jupiter, and beauty. Okay, so next, and then the great triad AMS. The mother letters representing air, water, and fire remain to be pictured. Around S, the central links or Yod. Well, I want to read this again. Okay. And then the great triad AMS, the mother letters representing air, water, and fire remain to be pictured. around S, the central lynx, or Yod, by the Ophionian triad, the two serpents, and the Leonine sphinx. So it's an odd phrase. AMS and AM and S stand for the three Hebrew mother letters, Aleph, Mem, and Sheen, which Westcott associates with the three causal sephira, Kether, Chokmah, and Bina, and which MPH suggests are illustrated by the three Ophite surrounding the IY and X. Serpents are often associated with causality, with the source of things, because they represent energy and sometimes fire. And so hence you have this association with the three mother letters. Next, Levi's word OPS, ops, in the center is the Latin ops, which means terra, genius of the earth, and the Greek ops, rhea or sibyl, or sebele, often drawn as a goddess seated in a chariot drawn by lions. She is crowned with turrets and holds a key. See the Ezeiac tablet, meaning referencing the book by Westcott. So this passage is taken directly from Levi's Transcendental Magic. In addition to genius of the earth, the word ops refers to the Roman earth goddess of plenty and the mother of the gods, who was consort to Saturn. In Hellenic myth, Ops was Rhea, the Titan mother of Zeus and the Olympians. In Phrygia, she is worshipped as Cybele, the Magna Mater, shown here as described in the text, in a chariot being drawn by two lions and crowned by turrets, as you can see here. The lions signify her mastery of untamed natural forces. The turret crown marks her role as protectress of cities and walls. The keys represent her authority to open and close the gates, not only of life and death, but also of the hidden mysteries. All three goddesses embody the same earth power and generative force, which is represented by this term, Rhea and Ops, Cybele, all three goddesses. And this is all represented by this symbol in Levi's illustration, which is related to this symbol as the source goddess. Okay, next. The essay published in French by Alexandre Lenoir in 1809, while curious and original, contains little real information on the tablet, which the author seeks to prove was an Egyptian calendar or astrological chart. So Lenoir wrote before Champollion's Rosetta Stone, before it deciphered Egyptian hieroglyphs. His method treats every symbol as a cosmic signpost, stars, months, zodiacal animals, yet never offers a coherent correspondence to any known Egyptian timekeeping system, for example, the 12-month civil calendar or the 36 decans, and is thus generally dismissed as a, quote, curious and original Romantic era fantasia. Let's hope nobody characterizes our lives by such a phrase. Next, as both Montfaucon and Lenoir, in fact, all writers on the subject since 1651 either have based their work upon that of Kircher or have been influenced considerably by him, a careful translation has been made of the latter's original article, 80 pages of 17th century Latin. The double page plates at the beginning of this chapter is a faithful reproduction made by Kircher from the engraving in the Museum of Hieroglyphics. The small letters and numbers used to designate the figures were added by him to clarify his commentary and will be used for the same purpose in this work. So, in short, Kircher became the de facto baseline source on the Mensa Isiaca that everyone else followed. So Westcott translated Kircher's original Latin and added the letters and numbers for easy reference. Okay, next up, the last paragraph of the section. Could we get a reader, please? Yeah, just raise your hand if you're willing to read. That would be terrific. Otherwise, I'll call on you. And if you don't want to read, that's fine. Okay, Ben.
I can read.
Okay,
Magda.
Thank you, Magda.
Like nearly all religious and philosophical antiquities, the Bimbine Table of Isis has been the subject of much controversy. In a footnote, A.E. Waite, unable to differentiate between the true and the purported nature or origin of the tablet, echoes the sentiments of J.G. Wilkinson, another eminent exotericus. The original table is exceedingly late and is roughly termed a forgery. On the other hand, Edward Winkelmann, a man of profound learning, defends the genuineness and antiquity of the tablet. A sincere consideration of the Mensa Isiaca discloses one fact of paramount importance, that although whoever fashioned the table was not necessarily an Egyptian, he was an initiate of the highest order, conversant with the most arcane tenets of Hermeticum esotericism. If I may say something about this.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Yes, the Mensa Isiaca is in the Egyptian Museum here in Turin, 1 hour from here in Italy, as well with a tablet of the Esmeralda tablet of Thoth. And all this discussion about the genuinity of the thing is, okay, it's not the original, and there is gold taken off of it, but is certainly crafted by someone that knows what this is. And what this tavola bambina is basically a way that the Egyptian initiates had to witness and tell us in the future how nature works, because we are studying here on a more Kabbalistic with Levi side, but there is a symbology in Turin that studies on a symbolical level and on a numerical level. So he says that there is always this recurrent theme on the upper strip of 12, because you see 4 by 3 figures, and on the lower strip of 4 by 3 figures. And then in the central strip, it looks like you've got 7 figures, but you got really 9. You got the 3 and the 3, and the Isis in the center, in this geometrical figure, is a trine. She's a 3 because she's the mother of Horus, she's the sister of Osiris, and she's the wife of Osiris, the one, the most important goddess of all, because thanks to her, you know, Seth killed her husband Osiris, so she had to find him in 14 pieces and find a 15th, which is the lingam. Without the lingam, she couldn't have given birth to Horus, and that's how nature works. All these the intervals of 4 by 3, of then 2 by 3, and of 4 by 3, which is more complex. But this to say that we need to understand that nature works on this dimension, on this multidimensional level, and also that all these Isis in Christianity, all these beautiful Isis myth, but our reality, of course, they were stripped off of their real nature, because they, you know, we are talking about the father, the son, and the mother, but it was taken off with the Mary's Isis, so it was taken away by calling this Holy Spirit, and no one really understands what it is, actually, you know, seriously, and it's purposely to nascond, to hide the most important secret of all, you know, which is reproduction and how nature works with the reconstruction. And also it's interesting that, well, I'll tell you a little later. For now, I'll leave it on. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, you remind me of how feminine oriented this tablet is, you know, that it really does put the Mother Nature, which is all manifestation, you know, not the limited role of, you know, a Mary type figure, at the very center as the source of all the emanations in this entire Mitzvah Isiaka. So, well, you know, you could get in your car right now, and by the end of the session, you could be in Turin and you could give us a video feed of the tablet, huh? Yeah, wow, how lucky. Have you ever gone down there to see it?
No, not personally. I don't really like the person who directs the museum, and have this prejudice I've had so far, because she really, you know, there are all these beautiful things that you got to explain, and it's so easy to explain them. There's this symbologies, you know, it's like in Italy, we have everything here, and, you know, Americans do all the money with all these numbered, you know, the Marvel movies and all this. And we are like, you know, this is how you put into action all those symbols and all those concepts. And you Americans do all this and we don't. So there's all this, you know, this controversy. But yes, it's a beautiful place to go. Turin is a very esoteric city. And the king of Italy was very fond of these pieces. He was the one, Savoia in Turin, the one bringing it. And then occultists, you know, they had to, you know, kind of, you know, it wasn't easy to do all this operation. But basically, like, it's as important as El Cairo in Egypt, this museum in Turin is as important. We don't have the pyramids, but we have this, so.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. MPH concedes here. Let me make sure I'm in the right place, yeah. Right. So MPH concedes that the table's creator was quote unquote not necessarily Egyptian, which flies in the face of his earlier assertion that it was used in the Great Pyramid during the initiation of Plato. More interesting is MPH's opinion that quote, he, the author of the Mensa Isiaka, was an initiate of the highest order, conversant with the most arcane tenets of Hermetic esotericism. I'm certainly not in a position to confirm or dispute MPH's view on this, though I am convinced mainly as a result of Westcott's interpretation that the overall design, you know, as Magda was describing, the numerology and the exploration that we've done so far reveals that it is, the Mensa Isiaka is an intentional, coherent, esoteric teaching. You know, it's not just a kind of an interesting decorative artifact at all. There's too much interrelationships between the figures and symbology within it. Okay. Next up, a new section entitled Symbolism of the Bembin Table. We've covered quite a bit of symbolism as we've gone along, but we'll pick up some of the loose ends as we read here. So could we get a reader, please, for this section? Anybody? Any volunteers?
Peter has his hand up.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead, please. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. First, I have a brief comment, if I may.
Yes,
let's go back to the planet symbols.
Okay.
I very much miss the word "the receptive" in the context of the crescent.
Oh yeah, well that's connected with. Oh, it's so far back. Let me get a. Hang on a sec.
You don't need to scroll back, I don't think.
I can do it this way quite easily. So this is our new section, that's 88. And I can easily do it this way. I just didn't realize it was so far back. So yeah, here's the group of the symbols. And this is the one of the two on the receptive aspect of the crescent. So what was your point then here?
Well, my point is that we have a correlation with the Chinese hexagrams. Hexagrams 1 and 2 are both represented. Also, with the moon, with the lunar crescent, we have emotions. Mm-hmm. But emotions is a smaller concept than the receptive.
Right. I think the receptivity is the fundamental idea. When you look at the two planets, especially Mercury, because this is the, you could call it the personal planet or that planet which directly impacts our process, it's certainly this idea of the the messenger of the gods, that is, it brings from what's on high and makes it available to us. I think that whole concept is represented by this half circle or semicircle. In Jupiter, it's a little more complex. I think it actually is referencing a greater circle here, but a receptivity to that greater circle, which allows it.
Yes.
Yeah, allows it to magnify for us those energies, right? It acts like an antenna for the solar system and brings it into availability for humanity. That's why Jupiter is considered, a sign of expansion or a planet of expansion. Yeah, well, thank you for your thoughts. I'm not versed enough Chinese hexagrams. I know them roughly to really relate the specific ones to these signs. But if you want to speak on that for a minute, that would be great.
Oh, it's way too many years ago I read the I Ching, but
you have
hexagram one. Right. Which is the Godhead.
Right.
And we have hexagram 2, which is, forgive me, Magna Mater.
Right, right. Exactly. So, and these are the two fundamental energies represented by a solid line and a dashed line, the masculine, feminine. And you could say that the receptivity is akin to that Magna Mater energetic. Is that your idea with that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, thanks for that. Any associations we can
use? Should I read?
Yes, let me get there. So we shifted down.
Sorry for derailing.
No, it all, I live for derailment. It makes these classes so much more interesting. To have this dialogue and to have me, broadening out this information. So I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Symbolism of the Bembein table. The following necessarily brief elucidation of the Bembein table is based upon a digest of the writings of Kircher, supplemented by other information gleaned by the present author from the mystical writings of the Chaldeans, the Hebrews, the Egyptians, and the Greeks. The temples of the Egyptians were so designed that the arrangement of chambers, decorations, and utensils was all of symbolic significance, as shown by the hieroglyphics that covered them. Beside the altar, which usually was in the center of each room, was the cistern of Nile water, which flowed in and out through unseen pipes. Here also were images of the gods in concatenated series, accompanied by magical inscriptions. In these temples, by the use of symbols and hieroglyphics, neophytes were instructed in the secrets of the sacerdotal caste. The Tablet of Isis was originally a table or altar, and its emblems were part of the mysteries explained by priests. Tables were dedicated to the various gods and goddesses. In this case, Isis was so honored. The substances from which the tables were made differed according to the relative dignities of the deities. The tables consecrated to Jupiter and Apollo were of gold. Those to Diana, Venus, and Juno were of silver. Those to the other superior gods of marble. Those to the lesser divinities were of wood. Tables were also made of metals corresponding to the planets, as they were governed by the various celestials. As food for the body is spread on a banquet table, so on these sacred altars were spread the symbols which, when understood, feed the invisible nature of man.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, so first, the following necessary brief elucidation of the Bimbine table is based upon a digest of the writings of Kircher, supplemented by other information gleaned by the present author, MPH, from the mystical writings of the Chaldeans, Hebrews, Egyptians, and Greeks. So this is an introductory sentence describing what's coming. So we'll continue. The temples of the Egyptians were so designed that the arrangement of chambers, decorations, and utensils was all of symbolic significance, as shown by the hieroglyphics that covered them. Indeed, the overall layout of the Egyptian temple, from the monumental pylons through the forecourt, hypostyle, hall, and sanctuary, mirrors the journey of the sun god Ra, which you can see here in this bark, across heaven and through the Duat, the underworld. Therefore, entering a temple is like following the solar bark itself, from the courtyard representing the dawn to the main hall representing midday to the inner shrine, which represents dusk and rebirth. Each transition point is marked by reliefs and inscriptions that underscore the theme of death, resurrection, and eternal life. Next. Beside the altar, which usually was in the center of each room, was a cistern of Nile water, which flowed in and out through unseen pipes. First of all, altars were placed in front of a statue or statues of the god or goddess to which the temple was dedicated, which was not necessarily in the center of a room, but always in line with the axis on which the temple was constructed. This alignment was either oriented in accordance with celestial events like solstices and or rising stars, you know, or with geographical features like the Nile or nearby hills. For example, the Temple of Amun at Karnak was built on an east-west axis, thus aligning it with the winter solstice sunrise, which allowed the sun's rays to penetrate the temple's innermost sanctuary on that day, illuminating the statue of Amun. Water was used extensively by priests for purification, but there is no archaeological evidence of unseen pipes leading to a cistern within the temple. MPH can get fanciful at times, and I just want to correct him wherein that occurs. Here also were images of the gods in concatenated series, accompanied by magical inscriptions. So often these series appear in horizontal bands on temple walls, depicting gods in some specific ritual, cosmological or genealogical order. For example, the Ogdoad of Khumun, shown here, the Pronaeus at the Temple of Hathor, and the 42 assessors, shown above here, of the dead in the Hall of Maat. Magical inscriptions were either spells to guide the soul through the afterlife, names and epithets of the gods to invoke their power, or formulae for offerings, protection, or transformation. These inscriptions were believed to activate the images themselves, making the gods present and potent through sacred words. Next. In these temples, by use of symbols and hieroglyphs, neophytes were instructed in the secrets of the sacerdotal caste. So these temples were not just places of worship, but were also mystery schools where visual and linguistic tools were used to transmit sacred knowledge, often in veiled allegorical form. A sacerdotal caste refers to some specific priesthood. Next, the Tablet of Isis was originally a table or altar, and its emblems were part of the mysteries explained by priests. Tables were dedicated to the various gods and goddesses. In this case, Isis was so honored. Okay. So after just stating that, quote, although whoever fashioned the table was not necessarily Egyptian, MPH once again suggests, as he did earlier in this chapter, that the Mensa Isiaca was used as a table by the Egyptian priesthood. It almost certainly was not, as its origins have archaeological been determined to be around the first century AD, in Italy, where it was found. Next, the substances from which the table were made differed according to the relative dignities of the deities. Tables consecrated to Jupiter and Apollo were of gold. Those of Diana, hang on just a second, I want to. There we go. Those of Diana, Venus, and Juno were of silver. Those to other superior gods of marble. Those to the lesser divinities of wood. Well, this is a great idea, but there's no archaeological evidence that ancient Egyptian temples used a formal hierarchy of materials like gold, silver, marble, wood, etc. for ritual tables. There's never been one found, that indicated that this took place. Actually, this symbolic hierarchy does exist, but it reflects Neoplatonic thinking written by the Neoplatonists, where material substance were given spiritual rank, as shown here. Also, the church picked up on this idea, often using metals in a hierarchical order. But like I said, there's absolutely no evidence that the Egyptians ever did this. I see Magda has a comment on that. So let me just go through this table, Magda, and then we'll hear from you on that. So the idea, this is the Neoplatonic belief system, is that Jupiter and Apollo were represented by gold, Diana, Venus, and Juno by silver. And that also could be just the male-female aspect, because male deity is often associated with gold and female with silver, marble representing other superior gods, and wood with lesser divinities. Yeah, it's an interesting use of, you know, the idea of using materials in this way is interesting. It's just a, you know, extending symbolism into these, into a further use. Okay, Magda, what's your retort?
Yes, for as much as it counts, they say that the silver part were removed, especially the silver parts, so the feminine lunar purity divinity part, but that's what I heard. And then also that is not a decoration, but is an altar in itself, or was an altar in itself, upon which they used to do the rites. The initiation.
Isiaka, right?
Yes, Miss Isiaka, yes. And ahead. The materials, you know, I think it might be true because the silver is missing, so the feminine is missing. This is really is showing the geometry of how is nature is done, because the central strip where Isis is one of the Platonic figures. It's a cubic structure. It represents a cubic structure which represents how the human template is made, and we go into tetragon and hexagon and tetrahedron, icosahedron, all the Platonic forms, and so the number that we are seeing is 216, that I think is also a sacred number. And then one question, when the other gentleman went back to show you those four signs, I wonder if the Mercury can be considered the father, and the Venus the mother, and the Jupiter the sun, the Horus. And we see, you know, here in the central strip, we said last time the Mercury was the central figure in the first triad. Then we have Osiris in the geometry figure, and then Horus in the central of the third triad. And the fourth, Saturn, who is in this, let's say, if it is admittable, one question is this, who would be Saturn here? And also the four, we always see this way of artistic putting, of Egyptian way of showing us where you can count, the way you stop counting. You see, we can count four. We can count four that look at toward the right hand side, and then someone goes the other way, gives his back to the first four, and then you say stop. So it's four, three, four, three, and it's the same thing that they're doing in this way. But Leonardo did the same thing of representing the same geometry in the Last Supper, which is also here in Milan. So he used the same model of cubic structure that also painting-wise, Dalí, Salvador Dalí, El Español, El Spanish guy, a painter, which is the last Rosicrucian, I mean, in history, that's how what they say. And he represented this beautiful thing of a man on the cross, a Jesus on the cross made of eight cubicles. So we are octave, we are an eight, we are eight in structure, and what we have to draw from this is that we have to respect this geometry that these people don't want us to know about it. So now it's time to really put this into work, and this is really, really nice. I have to get to this Levi because uniting also with Levi is beautiful, and that's it.
Okay, so just you know, for your benefit, this is the figure identified by Levi as Saturn. So it's the one immediately facing the IYNX or the Isis source figure, which is significant in itself, making this offering. So that's the Saturn. That's the one ascribed to Saturn. Okay, back up to where we were. here. We were looking at that. Okay. Yes, Peter.
Just a brief comment. We get for free an explanation of the Jewish temple and the symbology of it.
Oh, you see a correlation there.
Yes, we just have to delete the parts that don't fit into it.
Okay, interesting. Do you want to expand on that at all, or?
No, it was just, it came to mind that, now we understand it. Now we understand the table with the loaves of bread and all that.
Ah, I see. Okay, thank you. I saw two other hands flash up. What happened to you guys? Anybody? Any other comments?
Greg has his hand up.
Okay, I'm not seeing it. Oh, there it is, yeah. Yes, go ahead, Greg.
I saw that the triangle that was on that last figure set of in the Egyptian, there was a triangle related, but in that triangle there was Saturn, was the symbol for Saturn was on one end, the symbol for the moon was on the other end, and then the symbol of Jupiter was on the other end. So for me, in terms of what that represents, is that they're all grounded planetary expressions. They're more connected to Jupiter, yeah, than they are to anything else, and that Saturn, it's always been the limiter, the limitations of life, but it's also the living of the life, and then the moon is everything from before. So in that expression of the triple combination there, we see the moon, which is always, I've always associated the moon with what was before. Jupiter is what may become, and then Saturn is that whole process of releasing and letting go in time so that we can understand the limitations. And then we have to think about that as well in terms of the Earth chain, and Saturn was one of the earlier aspects of our own Earth chain, and so was the moon, which is part of our earlier rounds of our Earth chain. Or Earth scheme. I mean, so in terms of that, there is definitely a correlation and relationship, and in terms of all of the stuff that's involved with that.
Right. Yeah. You're talking about the Neptune triad. We're going to look at that closer, and you make good points. It's called the watery triad by MPH, and we'll be taking a closer look soon. Okay. Yes, Joe.
I came in late, but I have never, that I recall, experienced a sense of, I'm going to call it flame, in concrete or pillars. That entry that you had showing us from the outer chamber into the inner chamber and into the inner chamber. Just viewing that, there was a distinct sense of fire, flame, is what I'm trying to say to you, energy. Mm. Yeah, it was spatial. That yeah, to me was very interesting. Now I'm going to segue totally into current. About 10 years ago, I had the good fortune to go to Australia, and I brought back two opals. One is circular and the other is a teardrop, and another stone that comes directly from Australia, where you find jasper and a black stone, hematite, and cat's eye, all in one stone. And and this one happens to be oblong. So then I took these stones to a jeweler, and together we designed it. What I can see is the universality of what we're looking at in those tables, and then recognizing that, I would say intuitively, the person who made this for me and I together put together a piece of jewelry that reflects a exactly what we're seeing, you know, all kinds. I can see it in size. I can see it in color. I can see three different, in the gold and the silver that's incorporated. It's all reflective of what we're looking at in those tables from 2,000 years ago.
Thank you, Joe. Okay, finally, tables were also made of metals corresponding to the planets governed by the various celestials. As food for the body is spread on a banquet table, so on these sacred altars were spread the symbols which, when understood, feed the invisible nature of man. It's beautifully written. Here's a list of the metals associated with the seven planets and the traditional symbolic meaning of these metals. But again, and I agree with Magda that the Mensa Isiaca was a table and was used ceremonially. I don't think it was used by the ancient Egyptians, but I think it was used by a group, probably it was designed by a high initiate, and there was a group connected with the use of the Mensa Isiaca in some temple in the early Roman times. But as I said before, there's no archaeological evidence that there were these associations made with the planets in ancient Egypt. Okay, that was a later concept that came into being. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please? Anybody? Volunteers? Let me see who. Who is that?
Martha.
Yes, would you please? Thank you.
His introduction begin there, Francis? Please. In his introduction to the table, Kircher summarizes its symbolism thus, quote, "It teaches, in the first place, the whole constitution of the threefold world, archetypal, intellectual, and sensible. The supreme divinity is shown moving from the center to the circumference of a universe made up of both sensible and inanimate things, all of which are animated and agitated by the one supreme power which they call the Father Mind and represented by a threefold symbol. Here also are shown three triads from the Supreme One, each manifesting one attribute of the first trimurti. These triads are called the foundation, or the base of all things. In the table is also set forth the arrangement and distribution of those divine creatures that aid the Father Mind in the control of the universe. Here, in the upper panel, are to be seen the governors of the worlds, each with its fiery, ethereal, and material insignia. Here, also in the lower panel, are the fathers of fountains, whose duty it is to care for and preserve the principles of all things and sustain the inviolable laws of nature. Here are the gods of the spheres, and also those who wander from place to place, laboring with all substances and forms, Zonia and Azonia, grouped together as figures of both sexes with their faces turned to their superior deity." Unquote. The Mensa Isiaca, which is divided horizontally into three chambers or panels, may represent the ground plan of the chambers in which the Isiac mysteries were given. The central panel is divided into seven parts, or lesser rooms, and the lower has two gates, one at each end. The entire table contains 45 figures of first importance and a number of lesser symbols. The 45 main figures are grouped into 15 triads, of which 4 are in the upper panel, 7 in the central, and 4 in the lower.
Thank you, Martha. Okay, first, in his introduction to the table, Kircher summarizes its symbolism thus. It teaches, in the first place, the whole constitution of the threefold world, archetypal, intellectual, and sensible. So Kircher is here saying that every symbol on the table maps out how reality unfolds in three concentric realms. The highest of these is the archetypal, the realm of divine ideas, which corresponds to Plato's realm of perfect, unchanging prototypes, the blueprints from which all things derive. On the tablet, the sphere is represented by the highest order figures and hieroglyphs, which signify cosmic principles and primordial deities. The second realm is that of the intellect, where mind, or nous, contemplates and shapes the archetypes into intelligible patterns. This is the realm of abstract thought, divine intellect, and the ordering principles that structure the cosmos. Kircher sees parts of the table, such as the groupings of gods, geometric forms, and combinations of symbols, as encoding these expressions of the divine mind. The third is the sensible realm, representing the physical universe accessible to our five senses, matter, nature, and the visible world. Here, the archetypal and intellectual forces descend into form, giving rise to planets, elements, plants, animals, and humans. Certain elements in the lowest register of the tablet point to this material sphere and its governing laws. Next, the supreme divinity is shown moving from the center to the circumference of a universe made up of both sensible and inanimate things, all of which are animated and agitated by the one supreme power, which they call the Father Mind, and represented by a threefold symbol. So this is the emanation model prevalent in Neoplatonism. In the Mensa Isiaca, the source of life for all the figures and symbols comes from the IYNX figure at the center, which emanates the quote-unquote Father Mind, the universal intellect, or cosmic nous, which animates both the sensible and the animal kingdoms in nature. The threefold symbol represents the three cosmic functions of creation, preservation, and destruction. Next, here also are shown three triads from the Supreme One, each manifesting one attribute of the first trimurti. These triads are called the foundation, or the basis of all things. Okay, so the three foundational triads are found in the enclosure beneath Isis's throne, which in the original Mensa Isiaca are 9 small silver inlaid figures arranged in 3 distinct groups of 3, representing from left to right creation, preservation, and transformation. Next, in the table is also set forth the arrangement and distribution of those divine creatures that aid the Father Mind in control of the universe. Here, in the upper panel, are to be seen the governors of the worlds, each with its fiery, ethereal, and material insignia. So we've already taken a close look at the upper register shown here, which illustrates the 12 zodiacal signs, analyzing each triad of signs and identifying their role as pater, mens, and potentia. Here, MPH characterizes them as the, quote, governors of the world, who aid Father Mind in the control of the universe. An apt statement, since the 12 constellational lords are responsible for the delineation and diversification of cosmic mind into its subjective and objective influences in our solar system. As to the insignia, fiery insignia depicted by a torch, flame, brazier, or as in this triad, the upturned horns of the ram, symbolizes a spiritual or noumenal plane. Ethereal insignia, represented by a plume, a fan, or vase, stands for thought, breath, or subtle currents. And the material insignia, indicated by a basket, a bowl of seeds, or altar plaque, denotes earth, form, and the realm of the dense physical. By bearing all three, each governor embodies how a single cosmic principle manifests simultaneously as spirit, mind, and matter. Next, here also in the lower panel, are the fathers of fountains, whose duty it is to care for and preserve the principles of all things and sustain the inviolable laws of nature. Here are the gods of the spheres, and also those who wander from place to place, laboring with all substances and forms, zonia and azonia, grouped together as figures of both sexes with their faces turned to their superior deity. Okay, so here's the lower panel of the Mensa Isiaca and the key from Levi's illustration that identifies the gods and goddesses who reside in this lower panel. The quote unquote fathers of fountains we learned from Westcott are custodians of the primal springs from or sources from which all life and form emerges. So they're the custodians. They ensure that the archetypal principles, the metaphysical waters or ideas remain pure and ever flowing. They also maintain the fixed rhythms, the daily and annual motion of the sun, moon, and stars that uphold the cosmic harmony. Zonia and azonia, it's an interesting pair. They're paired male and female wandering deities who bridged the stable heavens of the upper register and the mutable material plane by traversing the boundaries between two neighboring cosmic domains, for example, from the sphere of Mars into that of Jupiter, or from an air zone into an earth zone. In so doing, they transport the specific quality or energy pattern belonging to the first domain into the second, ensuring that both momentum and archetypal power flow continuously through the cosmic hierarchy. It's a very elaborate, ingenious system that was conceived and illustrated in this tablet. Any thoughts or questions? Next, the Mensa Isiaca, which is divided horizontally into three chambers or panels, may represent the ground plan of the chambers in which the Isiac mysteries were given. The center panel is divided into seven parts or lesser rooms, and the lower has two gates, one at each end. So here MPH suggests that the Mensa Isiaca could represent a map of an actual, of an actual three-tiered, multi-chambered, two-gated sacred floor plan of a temple dedicated to the Isiac mysteries themselves. It's a very cool idea. I mean, I doubt that such a temple was ever built, may have been, but I doubt it. But even a mental construct of a temple, like a mental temple, could be used to sequentially and ritually experience the potencies of the Isiaca. Especially of note here is the idea of the two gates leading into and out of the lower tier. And finally, the entire table contains 45 figures of first importance and a number of lesser symbols. The 45 main figures are grouped into 15 triads, of which four are in the upper panel, seven in the central, and four in the lower. Okay, so Magda was giving us some insight as to the numerology of these. I could add that 4 plus 5 of the 45 adds to 9, which is a number of completion and, more importantly, of initiation. Also, passing from 4 to 5 is symbolic of moving from the 4th to the 5th kingdom and thus from the lower quaternary to the higher mental plane, which is under soul impress. Okay, next up, MPH lists the names of the 15 triads, which make up the 45 figures. So we're not going to read these. In the upper triad, we first have the Mendesian triad that's here. I meant in the upper tier. In the upper tier, we first have the Mendesian triad, which is shown here. Mendes means winter, which includes the signs Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces. The goat on the altar, a symbol of Capricorn, refers to the fecundity of the earth, ready to nourish the germs of growth. It was customary to sacrifice goats at the winter solstice as an appeal for a favorable season. Now, we've read about each of these triads. I'm just giving a few additional insights. If you want to go deep into the meaning of these triads, you can pick up the last two or three webinars on the Mensa Isiaca, where we went into deeper depth on each of them. Next is the Ammonian triad, meaning spring, composed of the signs Aries, Taurus, and Gemini. The ram Ammon, seen above, standing by a plant with, see up here, with three fructifying branches, is a symbol of the intense and ripening heat of the season. The Zohar says, quote, to denote heat, they drew a ram, the horns diverging upwards, being types of flames of fire. So you can see how important it is to understand the symbolism in order to have any clue as to what is being described in this Mensa Isiaca. Okay, we're going to pull the plug here. We'll get to the these triads that are described in this table. And in our next section, again, just thumbnails, sketches of each triad to get some idea of the overall sense of the meaning of the Mensa Isiaca. Okay, so let's see. This coming Friday is the next webinar. It's on A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. And that will be the first of the two webinars on TCF this month. And then in two Sundays, we have the Secret Doctrine webinar series. And then the Friday after that will be the second TCF series. Also coming up next week on the 9th, we have a full moon. And I think the pre-full moon, is it, let me see which it, where it is. Real quick. So the pre-full moon is on the 9th, yes, at 8 p.m. So yeah, during that, for those of you, I mean, probably many of you already know about it, but it's, I do an astrological rundown of the full moon, and then I explore the sign itself, aspects of the sign, whatever sign it is. This one will be Cancer. And then the labors of Hercules connected with that sign. And then we have a meditation, a pre-full moon meditation. Okay, thanks very much for your attendance. This webinar series is hanging by a thread, but we did manage to have 12 people. My cutoff is 10. So if you want to see this continue, keep coming. So because if it regularly falls below 10, I'll have to pull the plug on it. But I'm happy to continue developing this series as long as we have this many people. So we'll see you also the first Sunday of next month for the Secret Teachings of All Ages. Okay, that's it for today. Much thanks. I appreciate your attendance. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Francis.
Thank you, Veronica.
Thank you. Thank you, Francis.
Thank you, Martha. Yeah, Ben says the tablet is the temple. It's, yeah, it's a good comment. I like that. Okay. Appreciate all of you whose input. Peter, thank you. Okay, bye-bye.